The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Century of Lies, we continue our conversation with James Dixon. He's a research manager for the P5 Project YXE. That's the Perspectives, Pathways, and Priorities of People with Lived and Living Experience of Substance Use at the University of Saskatchewan College of Medicine. But first, Lisa Al-Hakim is Director of Operations for the People's Harm Reduction Alliance. Let me get back to asking you a couple about another project that you're involved with, and that's the Idaho Harm Reduction Project. You're on the board there. Tell me about that one. Where is it located? Well, obviously in the state of Idaho, but what cities?
Yeah, so Idaho Harm Reduction Project, I am the board chair of that organization, and they're fairly new. Syringe exchange was just legalized in Idaho, I believe, 2 years ago now. So yeah, we're fairly new. I spent my formative years in Idaho, which is my connection to that. And then a couple of folks who founded Idaho Harm Reduction Project, are from Idaho, but went to school at University of Washington and did volunteer hours at People's Harm Reduction Alliance. So that's how that all, and then I'm like, oh, I'm from Idaho. And so anyways, that's how that became a thing. So my mom still lives in Idaho, like lots of family there. So I still have a connection and I'm still there a lot, which is like why I'm on the, just to like expand on that. But, you know, they've done some amazing work in a couple of years, like stuff, you know, I always am like, you know, we have to remember, like, it was the people who like really came before us and like got arrested for, and still are getting arrested in certain states, you know, for just basic, like just looking out for people's health, which is just, you know, and I, again, it boils down to like, people don't see drug users as people. So again, with the Idaho Harm Reduction Project, like it's been a very interesting journey because of the like really, you know, Idaho's always been conservative. It's always been a red state. Well, not always, but for a really long time, it's been a red state. But not the same kind of red state it is now. You know, I think when I was growing up there, it was definitely a red state, but it was more like just leave me alone, kind of old man stuff, you know, like country kind of, you know, and I had like a mohawk when I lived there and stuff. And like, people were just like looking at me like, what the hell's wrong with her? But like, you know, nobody was like gonna jump out and, I got beat up a couple times, but that was, you know, I was not like afraid for my life most of the time. I feel like that shift from like kind of just like cranky old like redneck dudes into like totally insane proud boy, like wild people it's been like this transition I've watched it go through over the last like, you know, six years. And that really changed the dynamic of that entire state into like this very weird space. Like it was a very weird place, especially the Southern Idaho, like South, Western Idaho, which is kind of where we're based out. So Boise, Idaho is where we're based out of, where IHARP is based out of. But we also have a male-based thing. Like we also have like secondary exchanges in like the Panhandle and over the East. So there's like a pretty big reach in Idaho, and we do serve a lot of counties there. And we also partner with Next Distro, which is like, they do like mail order naloxone and that sort of thing. We also partner with them up here. But they like have a drop box in Boise. So it will look like a needle drop box. So it looks like a mailbox and you can just, which is pretty amazing. They also have a vending machine now, which we don't even have. So like, I was like, what? How did you get that? So, yeah. And so that's pretty amazing. Cause that's like harm reduction amazingness. Cause it's like, we always, you know, say like, if we were doing the best job we could do, we'd be open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, like all the time. But like in that way, that those supplies, Narcan, fentanyl test strips, like, you know, safe usage stuff. And, you know, like, that stuff can be available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, which is like amazing. So anyway, that's a little bit about what they're doing. Yeah, there's, you know, and they're trying, they're working, trying to work with the city. And I think Boise is a little bit easier to work with because it's a little bit more like, you know, left leaning than the entire rest of the state. But I know they do like a mobile thing. We just got a van, so that's cool too. You know, they're need based, like they're doing amazing stuff. So that's a little bit about them.
I've watched the evolution from a distance, from as we've gone from, you know, risk minimization projects and needle exchanges to syringe exchanges to syringe service programs. And it seems like that shift to syringe service programs, that seems rather significant. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think it's like a lot of, so, I mean, I think this is like, this started obviously with like listening to, you know, our community and being like, what do we need and want? Like, okay, so yes, we need like clean works to like use, you know, the things that we might be using safely. We need Narcan, we need fentanyl. Like these are all things that are like, but what else do we need? You know, like what else? We need other things, like, you know, like hepatitis C testing and treatment, because drug users are, you know, the largest population affected by hepatitis C. So like that makes total sense. Why wouldn't we be doing that? And then it's like, okay, wound care, obviously, like that's something that happened, you know, like soft tissue, you know, stuff and like abscess. So yeah, we need that. And then, you know, it just continues to kind of, well, we need food, you know, like, and if people are going to be taking like Hep C medication, or they're going to be like dehydrated, we need water, we need food. And so all these little things started to, I think, compile together. And I think this was really where we started. I think a lot of us were like, okay, so drug user health centers. So like a health center combined with a drop-in center kind of thing, which is what we've ended up moving into here. So we do have like a full, we have two physical sites that are like drop-in style with like wraparound health services and syringe access, obviously, overdose prevention, you know, obviously like vaccine stuff now. So all that stuff, like trying to get all of these things, you know, in house. So, and Suboxone, like, you know, maybe someday methadone, but who knows? But yeah, Suboxone, definitely have Suboxone on site. So like if people want, you know, some kind of treatment, specifically if they want Suboxone, they don't have to wait. We don't have to search anymore. It's like, it's right here, right now, this day, we can get it for you. And that has been like being able to go from like, when I started like not being able to ever find treatment for literally anybody who's like waiting lists and like, to like literally like picking up the phone and like having somebody do a video call next to me and then like walking them over to the pharmacy and their prescription's ready is like mind-blowing. So it's just all of these things, and we continue to expand on these things in the classic harm reduction way, where you expand without any more funding or people. So yeah.
You know, I was thinking because I had, of course, the wraparound services too.
Yeah, and most importantly, having that stuff in-house right there. Because, you know, obviously people are like, I need this right now. Well, we should have it right now if they need it right now. And also, if we're like, oh yeah, you can go to the hospital. Like most people who use drugs or live outside are not going to go to the hospital because they're going to get treated like garbage. So, you know, I mean, it's that age old story. We all know this, but I mean, that's why it's like trying to have all of those services in-house is like, you know, that would be a game changer. And I think that's what a lot of us are trying to work towards.
Because it's not just, I mean, you're the people who built up the trust. And that's the, a huge thing. I mean, even medical care,
Yeah, there's not a lot of trust there. And that's for good reason. And, you know, I mean, and I think it really does dovetail into, you know, talking about like vaccination too. And like, why like a lot of our folks like they're not doing it to be obstinate. They're doing it because they don't trust the medical industrial complex with reason, especially people of color and especially Black folks. You know, like, it's not as simple as this and that. There's like a lot of stuff in between. So again, like, as being somebody who's like a trusted person, a trusted entity, if I come to somebody and I'm like, hey, like, let's talk about the vaccine and talk about, you know, there's a lot of people who have like changed their minds and they're like, okay. And I'm like, I got it like 8 months ago and I'm cool. And I'm, you know, like, and just like having those conversations, you know. And USU has got some like really great literature around specifically like different drugs you might be using and the vaccine. And like, so, you know, I think like, people forget too, like, these conversations, we can have these conversations with people and we can actually, like, you know, because we're part of the community too, and we're like, hey, we use the same thing and we have the same concerns, and like, here's what happened to me, you know. And so that can be really effective and has been effective, you know. So yeah, people trust us with like most of that stuff a lot more than they do, you know, a hospital or some like sort of faceless doctor who's different every time they go in.
That was part of my conversation with Lisa Al-Hakim, Director of Operations for the People's Harm Reduction Alliance. Find them on the web at phra.org. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now, as promised, here's the second part of my conversation with James Dixon. He's research manager for the P5 Project YXE, the perspectives, pathways, and priorities of people with lived and living experience of substance use. Okay, so now Vancouver, as you mentioned, has actually submitted a proposal to Health Canada. They're trying to get their exemption. Can you tell us about some of the similarities between what Vancouver's doing and what's being discussed in Saskatoon?
For sure. So, yeah, as I'd mentioned, the exemption to the Canadian Drugs and Substances Act, Section 56, that's the approach that Vancouver has done. And that is potentially, like, that is the approach that Saskatoon may embark on. What I think is really interesting about that approach is, in the era of the overdose crisis, which has now been going on for, like, if we're just talking the fentanyl, the introduction of fentanyl, it's been at least like 6 years. And, you know, it's been around for a while, but it just really hasn't started bumping up until the last few years. But what I think is very interesting about this approach that these cities are doing is that really there's been so much death, there's been so much harm, there's been so much talk of need for structural and systemic changes such as decriminalization, but, you know, the federal government isn't really, like, they legalize cannabis in this term, like, they aren't, like, that, it doesn't seem likely that the feds are going to make a big change like that. Provinces, they like to say this is federal jurisdiction, and provinces don't, they also aren't really making any efforts to do that. And so I find that this is so interesting because cities are the spaces where they're seeing these problems play out, and that this exemption is really one of like the last political tools that are available to cities and city decision makers, because of the inaction that we've seen at the federal and provincial levels, this is one of the only things that a city can do legally to try to prevent overdose and death in that jurisdiction. And so it speaks to A, the shortcomings and the failures of our bigger governments that are beyond the municipal in doing what they need to do. Like, cities are now at this point that they're trying to do it because they're not seeing action at the higher levels. And what that also means is that if a city does apply for this exemption and say they are granted that exemption, like, I'll just use Saskatchewan as one example. Say Saskatoon puts in a proposal, we get the exemption and drugs are decriminalized in Saskatoon. Awesome. That's incredible for the city of Saskatoon. Regina, however, maybe doesn't get, they don't do that. They don't submit a proposal. They think it's a bad idea. And so now we have two jurisdictions in the same province that have different laws around this type of thing, and it becomes an equity issue. And then, like, and how is that sustainable? Because we can't have some cities where people can, like, have possession of drugs and not be criminalized, but then other ones that do, that's just, that's unfair law practice. And so that cities are taking this approach is incredible, because you can see that they're on the front lines of these, of drug crises, and that this is where all the, this is where they're seeing these crises play out. But in the long term, this needs to be a federal legislation, and an exemption to federal legislation is good for the moment and in the interim. But at the end of the day, it's that piece of legislation, it's that Section 56 that needs to change. And I'm glad cities are standing up for this, because, like I said, a lot of other stakeholders, everybody, healthcare professionals, police, advocacy groups, user groups, academics, there have been people from all walks of life who are saying we need to do this. And the federal government is still, like, they hear it, but they won't hear it. And so that cities are now including, are in this voice, or are, like, sharing their voices and are taking steps to do this, I think is just strengthening this resolve. And, you know, if enough cities start to do this, that is, like, that is what's going to help start changing that legislation, when so many folks are getting exempted from it, that like, it's part of the change making process, and it's slow. And we all know that by being so slow, every day that passes, we're losing more and more lives that don't need to be lost. But, like, this is the corner that we're pushed into. Like, we don't have, like, there aren't that many options. How many more things can we say? How much more evidence can we show? How many more people have to die? Apparently, there's an infinite number of all of those things, because, you know, deaths are still happening, the evidence is still ignored, and, you know, we're still just responding to the crisis. We're not actually addressing some of these root causes of why it's happening in the first place. So that was the point that I wanted to make, that these exemptions are important, but they are an important piece, but they aren't the ultimate end solution that needs to take place. And that by having them in place, they're starting to open up more questions that aren't bad, but just are furthering along this process.
Well, let's go back to Vancouver for a moment. Recently, activists there with the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users and with the Drug User Liberation Front have held actions at which they have distributed drugs, tested, specially procured small amounts, tested, known quantities, known quality, known potency. Everything is has been checked using lab equipment, and people who use drugs have been able to get some of this actual, as it were, safe supply. It's the frustration. I think it's grown. It comes from frustration with a lack of action from the authorities and the people who should be doing this stuff. And people finally decide, you know what, to heck with it. Let's just do this. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that safe supply piece, even if we look a few years ago when overdose prevention sites and safe consumption sites still weren't, you know, legally allowed, but people just did it anyway. And I think that's kind of that same sentiment. And, you know, this has now been years of this sentiment building up. Like, we had to fight. People had to fight just for the overdose prevention sites. People had to fight for safe consumption. And, you know, every single piece of federal legislation or even provincial legislation that has happened has been because of, you know, people on the front lines putting it out there and fighting for it. So I love that there are people who are truly putting themselves out there with a safe supply. And yeah, it's limited, but, you know, these are baby steps, one step at a time. And when you know what the difference between a safe supply of drugs and a not safe supply is, Like, where's the moral imperative is to do the right thing, is to do the safe thing. So I'm constantly impressed and inspired by the folks who literally will stand on the front line and challenge some of these, like, these federal laws by doing the right thing. And that's how we've seen a lot of movement, is through the courage and the bravery of the folks who are doing this. And I just also think it's so important to note that this whole safe supply conversation, I think a lot of people put a lot of weight on what decriminalization is. And they think that if we decriminalize drugs, the expectation is then like, oh, we've decriminalized drugs, things are going to be better. Everything is going to be, we're going to solve our drug problems. But that is not the case. Decriminalization is one step. It's one intervention. It's a very important intervention, because the criminalization of drugs is easily the driving force of stigma. And stigma is just, if not probably one of the most serious obstacles and barriers that people who use drugs face. But decriminalization, it addresses one piece of this puzzle, but it is not the silver bullet. That decriminalization in conjunction with a safe supply of drugs, in conjunction with better early childhood interventions and meaningful prevention programming, you know, it's a basket of things that we need to do in order to prevent drug harms, but to also just create healthier people and things like that anyway. So I love that you brought up safe supply, because in a similar way, you know, a lot of this decrim stuff that's been going on has been led by folks who are willing to challenge some of these statutes and these laws. And now we're starting to see that conversation become a much more common conversation and discussion with the safe supply talk, because I think people are starting to understand decrim a little bit more. But a safe supply of drugs, what does that mean? What does that look like? And it begs a lot of questions. What is a safe supply of drugs? Does that mean I can just go to a 7-Eleven and pick up, you know, an ounce of something like it? And like, can I just go to the store to grab some heroin or whatever? Like, it, people get scared by the conversation about what is safe supply, but it is a conversation that needs to happen. And how a safe supply looks and how it works, you know, I don't know if anybody has full answers about that yet, because we're still kind of like, we're figuring, or at least there are people who are working on that, I'm sure, in the underground community and on the front line, they have a lot of ideas and things that already work. There's a lot to learn, but this conversation itself is one that I think is now starting to become more common, and it needs to be. But, you know, that's another avenue where it's going to be an uphill battle, and similar to the decrim, but also in a different way, just because these are different policies and legislation that looks over that. So, they're a basket of things that are needed if we want to actually make change, see drug reform, and prevent harms for people. And decriminalization, safe supply are just two pretty big ones. They're pretty big ones, but are two in a basket of options that we need.
Well, it's like decriminalizing back in the 1970s. If we actually had done that nationally, I don't know if we'd have had a marijuana movement. I mean, if we'd have just decriminalized and, you know, decided, yeah, you're right, this is all kind of stupid, why don't we do the right thing? Wouldn't probably have the cannabis industry that we have now. Wouldn't probably mean a lot of things. Yeah.
It's the restrictions and the constraints that foster resistance, community building, and change, really. Like, it's when the systems fail us, that's what brings people together to create change. And our systems, our drug policies and our drug systems are just failing us. They're failing us. That's not to say that, you know, people who work in them, you know, I'm not trying to paint some like broad strokes saying that everybody who's in this system is bad or terrible, but just that they're predicated on this criminalization prohibition. And, you know, they're just rooted in these kind of false beliefs and ideas about what drugs are and what people who use drugs are and what they're like. And yeah, it's when you have flawed roots, your system is going to grow flawed. So there's a lot of great work that's happening out there, of course, but you know, we need to address some of these roots that are driving these harms in the first place.
Exactly.
And to see then will allow the rest of the system to blossom. Like once we address this, what does that mean? Treatment and stigma and harm reduction. If we stop criminalizing them, like what does that mean for those things? It seems like it would make it easier to access them. There are a lot of benefits. So if we address the roots, the growth around it will go much beyond that.
And do you have any closing thoughts for our listeners?
You know, my initial closing thought was that decriminalization isn't the silver bullet solution, that we need to consider it in conjunction to a safe supply and meaningful prevention. I think another thing that is also overlooked is prevention. I feel like the world that we live in is becoming increasingly challenging. It's driving a lot of pain, a lot of suffering, and that if we start to more meaningfully talk about things like mental health, more meaningfully talk about coping and, you know, just challenges that we have, if that starts earlier, starts younger, like if we start talking about these things more openly in schools, and if we can just kind of open this conversation that it's okay to feel bad, it's okay to be vulnerable in some spaces, it's okay to have a mental health, it's okay to be depressed, it's okay to be anxious. Like, let's start, you know, talking about this, and let's start just doing what we can so that folks who maybe at some point in their lives don't get to a point where they start turning to some more harmful coping mechanisms. But if we start to, you know, meaningfully address them at some of these root causes and teach people how to just live at peace in this world with themselves, despite living in a garbage world. I don't want to be too bleak, but it's a tough, like we live in a tough time right now. There's a lot of division, climate change, so much pain, so much suffering, the overdose crisis, like lives are being lost. The rich keep getting richer and are fighting about going to space, whereas we can't even feed, you know, all the children or just all the humans all across the world. Like it's a weird world. And I think our governments honestly owe it to our people to, you know, try to, you know, give us the tools we need to survive this.
That was from my conversation with James Dixon. He's a research manager for the P5 Project YXE. That's the Perspectives, Pathways, and Priorities of People with Lived and Living Experience of Substance Use at the University of Saskatchewan College of Medicine. And for now, folks, that's it. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.